Welcome to Our House, the only complete on-air resource for your home ownership needs. Now, here's the host of Our House, Peter Hunt.
Good morning and welcome to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the all-new HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience. I encourage you to go there today. It's the only place on the web where you can actually find three algorithms to help you determine the value of your home or any home in any of the markets we serve. HuntRealEstate.com is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA, and here in Buffalo, Niagara, all across upstate through Rochester, Syracuse, the greater Albany area, Utica, Watertown, and even up to Phoenix, Arizona. And our newest market is the Boston, Massachusetts market, and we have moved into that market by acquiring a firm there in the western suburbs, and we're very happy to be part of that marketplace. The show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage. I encourage you to call them today at 633-3700 and ask one of our skilled mortgage consultants to work with you to find the lowest rate and closing costs for your next home financing needs and wants. Also ask about our many exclusive programs, including our pre-purchase commitment that allows you at no cost or risk to effectively enter the market to find your next home with cash. And that's exclusive to Hunt Mortgage at 633-3700. And we guarantee along the way personalized, customized, what we like to call knock your socks off service, and check out that low rate guarantee. Certain restrictions do apply, but it is lowest rate and closing costs for any mortgage product in the market, and that's guaranteed. That's at huntmortgage.com or 633-3700. And don't forget about the first ever 24/7 365 real estate hotline, which we're enhancing right now. The Hunt Hotline, which gives you access to all available information about any property listed for sale here in Buffalo, Niagara, all across upstate, and even out to Phoenix, Arizona. Simply dial 716-631-4800, enter the street number of the house you want to know about, no matter whose listing it is, and the hotline will prompt you with a choice of street names. All you have to do is select the one you want. You'll hear a brief description, and then you'll be texted a link to a dedicated website on that particular property, all automatically and just that fast, anytime in any market we serve on any listing. It doesn't have to be our listing. Any listing. You see a sign in front of a house, you don't have to stop and write down the phone number or try to decipher all the different ways you can access an agent or whatever. All you have to do is dial 631-4800, and all the information will be at your fingertips in no time at all. It's faster than actually going to the web, so I encourage you to try that system today. It's available only through Hunt Real Estate ERA. This is a very exciting time in the market. The month of July was our best month in our company's history, and it's an interesting time in the real estate market, because I'm sure if you're watching the real estate press at all, what you're seeing is that there's a shortage of inventory and that there's multiple offers. Well, that's beginning to change. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal in the last couple of weeks that addressed this issue in some of the hotter markets, Portland, Oregon, places like that, that have been kind of red hot for a long time. Things are beginning to slow. Certainly in the high end of the marketplace, it's beginning to slow. And that really doesn't affect us here in upstate New York very much. But there are certain things about our marketplace that do affect us in all aspects of our life. And to help me discuss this topic from a particular standpoint, in the studio with me today is John Hurley, who is the president of Canisius College. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Peter.
It's good to have you back. You were here in April. That's a relatively short time ago. So, but you know, there's a lot going on here, and you are kind of in the thick of it, leading an institution like Canisius, which is kind of a bedrock institution in Western New York, from a standpoint of, as you look around the community, you talk to people in the business community where they went to school. We have a high percentage of your graduates that seem to stick around town. Do you have any records on that? Do you have any kind of detail and how much of an impact you have in various sectors of the economy here? I mean, historically?
Well, we had a branding campaign for years that used the tagline, Canisius College, where leaders are made. And we felt that kind of summarized in a couple of words what the college was all about. Because if you looked across Western New York, in every walk of life, the most prominent people in the community, yes, were Canisius College graduates. But
some exceptions, of course.
Yes. There were some that went to St. Lawrence,
yes,
too.
A couple.
But about 70% of our alumni are here locally.
Really?
And making, I think, making a real impact in this community every single day. And it's something that we teach, and it's something we take a great pride in.
You have extended your reach as you you've grown and developed the school. What is the general geographic reach of applicants to Canisius today? And then you say 70% of the alumni are local. How many of those people started local and then stayed local, or how many people came from outside? I'm trying to understand what a draw of a university is like yours that really then helps to expand our intellectual base here in our community.
Yeah, we draw about two-thirds of our freshman class from the eight counties of Western New York. About 90% of the students come from New York State, so we'll have a lot of activity in the Rochester, Syracuse, Albany, and then a little less so in the New York City, Long Island markets, although we'd like it to be more. Generally speaking, across the country, 80% of the college students attend college within 200 miles of their home. So when you start to think about a recruiting radius, most schools will spend 80% of the resources in that 200-mile radius. The problem for schools in the Buffalo area is that when you start to draw that radius, you hit water, a lot of water, and then you hit Canada. Mm-hmm. And Canada is a market for us somewhat, but the tuition differential is great. You can go to the University of Toronto or McMaster or Guelph for $8,000 to $9,000 a year. And wow. So for the undergraduate market, it's just not a great recruiting market for us.
Mm-hmm. Unless, of course, you're providing deep incentives for them to jump.
That's right. And we do find students who, for example, want to play Division I sports. So we'll recruit hockey players, baseball players, lacrosse players mm-hmm. from Canada. But the rank-and-file college student, it's a challenge.
It's expensive to run a Division I sports program. How many of your sports at Canisius are Division I?
Division I is structured in such a way that if you're Division I in one sport, you're Division I in everything.
There are some exceptions to that, though.
The exceptions are for hockey and lacrosse. Mm-hmm. So there are Division III schools that are playing Division I hockey. They are grandfathered in, and the same with lacrosse. But generally speaking, so if you're Division I, you're Division I in everything.
So you're Division I across the board.
Yes, and so the challenge for schools like Canisius is to find a conference where you can be with like-minded schools who have a similar approach to athletics, and we think we do in the Metro Atlantic Conference and also in the Atlantic Hockey Conference that we're a member of.
Break down the school for us a little bit, John. We haven't done this in a while. How many undergraduate students do you have? Will you have this fall? How many graduate students, and how many in what schools in that graduate program?
Yeah, so we're at about 2,200 undergrads, and there are three schools within Canisius College, a College of Arts and Sciences, the Whaley School of Business, and the School of Education and Human Services. And we're offering about 70 different undergraduate programs for those students. On the graduate level, we have about 1,100 graduate students. We run the third largest MBA program in the region, trailing only the University of Buffalo and the Simon School at the University of Rochester. And we have a large number of programs in the School of Education, mainly teacher certification, where you need a master's degree to be teaching in the school systems. And then there's an assortment of a couple of other programs in that. We're just introducing this fall, for example, a master's degree in data analytics. So this is the big data program that is driving so many sectors of our economy. But clearly banks are a big target for big data. But healthcare is trying to manage big data. And so this is a high-level computer science, mathematics, and finance program.
On this show, we've heard from other leaders in our community that speak to the issue of the number of job vacancies we're going to have through aging out and retirements and just people moving and the needs of industry that are changing here in our community. That number seems to be somewhere around 165,000 165,000 vacancies for jobs in the next, I can't remember exactly how many years, but it's coming up. It's upon us now. How closely do you work with the other schools in this area, even the United Way and the Buffalo Niagara Partnership to really understand how you can predict, such as through a data analytics program, the needs of our economic environment here, so that you can train people that actually will get jobs and be productive parts of our economy here?
Yeah, that's a great question. And when you hear about the total number of jobs, I mean, it is something that we're watching. But you have to break that down as to what areas are those falling. So, for example, right now the Buffalo Niagara Partnership is very involved in a workforce development program that I think is focused more so on advanced manufacturing and I would say more vocational needs in this community. So they're working very heavily with the Northland project over on the east side, and trying to find, is there a way we can take underemployed sectors of the population in the Buffalo market and prepare them for jobs? When we look at jobs that require either a bachelor's degree or a master's degree, I think every one of the colleges and universities in this area are looking at labor market analytics and are using those analytics to predict where is their job growth, where do we need to have programs that will meet the demands, and then how do we develop such a program, and what fits within a particular school's expertise. So we work with a research firm that really does, I'm very impressed with the quality of the research. They'll tell you what the job market looks like in New York State, in the region, nationally. They'll tell you what the number of programs are that are currently aimed at filling that, and whether there is capacity or not. And that helps us to really develop relevant programs that have market appeal.
It seems to me that every community is facing something similar throughout the whole country, perhaps all of North America, major cities in North America, as well as Western Europe and even the Far East. How do we as a community compete in that environment? Because not only do we have to fill the jobs here, we have to worry about how industries are going to want to stay here and then not be recruited away because we don't have that labor force to fill those jobs, not to mention the tax and regulatory situation.
Yeah, Peter, I would think that my experience is that the bigger problem here is not that the colleges and universities don't have the programs, or that we don't have the training programs, or that we're not thinking about this. It's driven, I think, first and foremost by the demographics. Despite a lot of brave talk, the fact is that New York is still losing population. And as we prepare for the 2020 census, I would suspect that New York is probably going to lose at least one more congressional seat as a result of population loss.
Well, just explore the why of that from your perspective.
Well, I think there are two components to it. One is the current generation, and this has been going on for 20 years, and we're seeing it now. Young people are getting married later, and they're having fewer children. So that's a phenomena that you can see playing out in Europe, in Japan. It's the case in a lot of with a lot of developed economies. The second part, though, I think, is more of a New York issue. I think the climate, the economic climate, has driven business away, and therefore you see real population loss in addition to these sociological factors.
You know, it's interesting to watch right now the political campaigns as they begin to unfold, particularly at the state level, and the rhetoric that goes along with that. It seems to me that we in New York State have positioned ourselves as being the beacon for, I guess, redistribution of income would be the best way for me to describe this. And the fact that many parts of the political spectrum, not just one, believe that there's the answer to a lot of our issues is just kind of a forced redistribution of income. In other words, there's plenty of wealthy people in this town or this state, so let's extract more from them to make our state a friendlier state for lots of different groups. And I'm not speaking. There's no value judgment in that. It just seems to be the way the rhetoric is going. What that ignores in my mind is the mobility of capital, the mobility of the process of economic development. It doesn't have to stay here, and to me, it really begs a discussion of how we look at this in a very holistic sense, and not just in a New York State sense. And I think sometimes we think there's a big wall around this state that people just can't cross the border to any state and have a, let's say, a friendlier environment to their business. So this has to weigh on you. It has to weigh on everybody running a business or running any institution in this town, because if one of those wealthy people is chased out of this state or any state to another state, it takes a great many lower-level earners, immigrants, even just middle-class families to make up the difference in the taxes that those people were paying to make that up, so that we impose a tax or a regulatory situation on any individual or industry, and all of a sudden the ripple effect goes deep and far. Are you sensitive? I know you're sensitive to this, but in what way, shape, or form does that affect a place like Canisius?
Well, it's got a great impact. People ask me what's the toughest part of my job, and most days I say it's trying to run an institution in New York State with the regulations and the state control that impact you. But I've become a follower of the Empire Center in Albany, which is a think tank, and they do a lot of research. I saw it described recently as a conservative think tank. I think it's just a factual think tank. They get to the bottom of this. And to your point, I saw research recently that they said New York is at a high point in terms of its reliance on high-income taxpayers to support its budget. And it's well beyond a tipping point. And so every one of those taxpayers who is encouraged to leave the state does create a big, big hole. And you've got to make it up with lots of other little people. So right now, to be...
Who you don't want to tax.
Who you don't want to tax, and, right. And who you shouldn't tax.
Right,
if you're sincerely interested in a fairer system and any sort of fair shake for people at the bottom of the ladder, you don't want to tax them. So it's a difficult challenge in New York, and it doesn't seem to me to be the time for New York to be positioning itself as the progressive beacon in the country, because as you and I know, it's not a question of is this going to be free or not? It's a question of who's going to pay for it.
That's right. And, you refer to this, the work of the Empire Center, and I'm sure somewhere in their work they cite the fact that other communities that have a labor shortage will look at a community like Buffalo and say, if you, at any level, even lower level, we will pay for your move to our community. Bring your family. We'll set you up. We'll give you a little incentive to come to our state. By the way, the taxes will be lower, and you can buy a house for a reasonable amount of money. And it's not, they're not just appealing to the wealthiest people, and that's kind of nothing particularly new. But as the labor market tightens, I think this is going to be a growing trend. And I don't know if you see that or not. But for example, your graduates, I'm sure that the better qualified graduates that can fit into some kind of labor niche, so to speak, in any community, are going to be recruited to go lots of different places.
Well, they are, but one of the good news stories here locally. I mean, we've been kind of talking about the challenges, but one of the good news stories is the number of, I would say, entry level jobs and opportunities. The number of opportunities for young people has really increased over the last decade, and so we're seeing more of our graduates stay in the community and make a go of it, and And I think one of the real drivers of that is there's a real increased focus in the community on entrepreneurship, on new business development, and you see young people gravitating toward that. So we're aware of so many of our young graduates who are doing really creative, interesting things and trying to get ventures off the ground. That'll be good for the community if we don't tax them and regulate them and discourage them.
To push them out. I'm sure at places like the Empire Center, they're looking at a whole multitude of factors. Lifestyle, housing costs, all those things factor into whether or not we are a desirable place to be or not. And like you say, to a young person who's looking to rent a house or rent an apartment or buy a house, how much that will cost and the availability of something like that weighs into their decision to stay or go. And as you point out, a lot of your students are local, have local families, and the desire to stay local means a lot. And I think as families age and grow up, that becomes even more important, fortunately, I think, and to our community. But we've got to go to a break in just a minute here. But before we go to a break, what is your entrepreneurship? Do you have an entrepreneurship program at Canisius now?
We do. In the Whaley School of Business, we have an entrepreneurship major, and then a lot of students are just in taking a general business curriculum, but are taking courses, and it's been interesting to watch that happen. We have an entrepreneurs council, alumni and friends in the community who come in and work with the students. They'll work with them on an elevator pitch program, and it's been a great program.
And we'll be right back with more from our host here after these important messages.
Hi, this is Linda Malaya, president of Hunt Mortgage. When it comes to the single biggest purchase of your life, it pays to shop around. If you think you've found the best rate available for your home loan, why not let us take a second look? We'll review your rates and your terms and try to see if we can do better. And just for giving us a shot, we'll give you a $50 gift card.
Hunt Mortgage is a licensed mortgage banker, New York Department of Financial Services, and an equal opportunity lender.
Welcome back to our house. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the all-new HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience. HuntRealEstate.com is the only place on the web where you can find a complete inventory of homes, not just here in Buffalo, Niagara, but all across upstate and even out to Phoenix, Arizona, and soon to Boston, Massachusetts. You also find access to a complete set of home ownership services at HuntRealEstate.com, which is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA. The show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, and for more information about our many exclusive programs, including the one that allows you to roll the costs of home improvements into your mortgage, allowing you to effectively buy the before and live the after, call 633-3700 and ask for details. Also ask about our pre-purchase commitment. I mentioned it earlier in the show. That effectively allows you to enter the market with cash, because your offer with a mortgage commitment is equivalent in terms of actually what will happen at the closing table to another offer that would have cash on it. So you'll want to know about that, because it puts you in the best position in this very tight inventory market, so that when you find a home that you like, you'll be able to compete and win for that house. And stop into one of our many open houses this weekend and ask one of our agents that you meet there about our seller security plan, which is a guarantee that you're going to be able to not only have a pre-purchase commitment, but also that your home will be effectively sold and you won't have to buy contingent. And very simply, we will sell your home, or ER will buy it. So if you have a home to sell and that's a problem in your mind about making the move to the next house that you found that you love, don't worry about it. Just contact one of our agents and ask about the seller security plan. I'm in the studio today with John Hurley. Mr. Hurley is the president of Canisius College, and we've been talking a lot about our community here, and a little bit about, we started the show a little bit with a discussion of Canisius itself and the alumni profile that you have there. But let's go back to, if we can, and I don't want this to be a negative discussion, because I think there's a lot of things are different today than they were 10 years ago or 15 years ago relative to our attitude about our community and where the community is going. But underlying that discussion is kind of a feeling that seems to be growing in our community, that there's kind of a glass ceiling, that because of the things we were talking about in the last segment, the tax situation, regulatory situation, et cetera, in the state, competitively speaking, that things like rents, value of real estate, are there's a ceiling on them. And where this perhaps is most pronounced, and this has to be something that you're sensitive to, is in the commercial market. In the commercial market, rents have really not gone up very much in a long time. And as you look at investments on your campus, you have to consider, and I know you do, you have to consider the relative use of capital. In other words, what makes sense? And I know you've done a lot of expansion going back to even before you were president and the job that you had at Canisius, but how do you look at that, and how do you evaluate the next move physically on the campus itself in terms of the community as a whole?
Well, the one, and this is a good news story, I think the value of our campus has gone up with the development in the city. And there are things about our campus that, I mean, I've changed my way of looking at them in the last 5 years. And a lot of that's driven by what's going on at the medical campus, but it's interest in the city generally. But in higher education generally, I would say there are a couple of things. One is the demographics are not great. We've seen a big decline in the number of high school graduates, and as far as the eye can see, we're looking at a lower student population. So it's causing a lot of schools to rethink capital investments. Similarly, the move to online education means that the bricks and mortar part of higher education have to be rethought. Now, Canisius is going to always offer, I think, a residential, in-person education on the undergraduate level. But we've found in the graduate programs, we're now offering 13 graduate programs that are either wholly or partly online. And in every case where we had a face-to-face program and we developed an online counterpart, we saw the enrollment migrate to the online environment. So that has really profound implications for the physical plant of the college.
Let me stop you there. One of the things I've heard, and I don't know this to be a fact, is that that's happening at many parts of the country right now. But the graduation rate is longer and is lower with the online programs because there isn't the social or the human interactive part of it. Is that just a theory, or is that fact in your mind?
I think it's a theory. I think it depends. It really depends what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. There was a phenomena, and it's not really clear where this one is going, of what we called MOOCs, or massive open online courses. Mm-hmm. And Harvard and MIT and Stanford were involved in for-profit ventures to develop these. And the idea was you would take world-class lecturers and develop a course, the definitive course on X that would be delivered by this professor. And everyone would sign up, and you'd have thousands and thousands of people enrolled in this course. And what they found in the early experience with that is the completion rate on the courses was not great. Mm-hmm. And the pedagogy, didn't really work for a lot of people. But on the other hand, we found in the graduate programs at Canisius, where we've gone to online, people are driven. What they want is the convenience. Working adults want to be able to do the courses when they have time. And the idea that you have to have people physically present on, say, a Tuesday night at 7 o'clock on the campus is just breaking apart. So that's on that part of the business, the completion rates are very high. And the other thing you find, it's kind of funny, I don't know that there are any deep studies on this, but students who might be introverted or might sit in the back of the class and never participate in a live classroom, there's evidence that they flower in the online environment. Suddenly they're participating because they're in a medium that's comfortable for them. So it's caused a lot of education experts to think about, like, what is the nature of the classroom experience and how do you reach people and really reach all people in a classroom.
Would you say then that many schools have a kind of a 100% residential requirement in many cases? Is that a dying breed, or let's say a slowly vanishing breed?
No, I would say there's going to be a substantial demand for that because In the United States, I think we've seen it with our own children, and we saw it with ourselves. I mean, the college-going experience, it's not just the education. It's mm-hmm. everything else that goes along with it.
Independence, getting away from home, all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there's still going to be a demand for that. However, growth in education, and if we start to look at education as a lifelong endeavor, the undergraduate degree that you get is not going to be sufficient for what you need to do over the course of your lifetime. Then colleges and universities need to be thinking about how do you reach people for lifelong learning, and that's something that we're grappling with right now at Canisius. What are the programs that you would offer? And it's not just strictly speaking degree granting programs. As I tell people, we have to stop thinking of ourselves as in the degree granting business. We're in the knowledge business, and the question is, how do you package knowledge in ways that people need it and are willing to access it?
Long before you were president, you became president of Canisius. We actually partnered with Canisius to develop our own leadership development program. Is that kind of thing growing is it becoming more common for an industry or company to come to you and say, look, we don't need the whole MBA, but we need six courses here that you happen to have. Could we work together?
Yes, and that's where I see the growth, because for precisely that thing, that reason. You know, a young adult might say, well, I think I want an MBA, but I don't think I need the whole suite of courses.
Or if you've already got a job and the company knows that you need greater expertise, it's a big deal to send you away to an MBA program, or even if you go at night or whatever on weekends, it's a big deal to have you out of the office. But if it was part of the company program itself, so that you see that growing.
Yes, yes. And that's where lifelong learning is going.
And I think this is critically important. And I don't know, we could talk about that all day, because we're examining that inside our own company right now. There's there's not enough of a push inside our industry, for example, at all levels in the various companies, various aspects of the industry that we represent, mortgage, title, insurance, real estate itself, commercial, residential. There's not enough emphasis on the skills, the evolution of the skills needed to stay in step with the marketplace. And what we're seeing as a result in our industry, and I think this might be true in many industries, is there's a growing crisis in value. The consumer, because of technology, has access to more information about everything. And the link between the consumer and the manufacturer or the product development element of industry is getting closer and closer and closer. Things like Amazon have changed the world of retail, for example. So in that environment, we have to redefine our own value. And I would think a discussion like that with a school like yours from any industry would make a lot of sense to your lifelong learning concept.
Absolutely, because, you know, I look at the typical 22 or 23-year-old who is graduating from Canisius College, and you say, now, is that person equipped to handle everything that the world is going to throw at them? We think we do a pretty good job in lots of areas. But increasingly, if you look at what the labor market wants, they want people with strong critical thinking skills, the ability to read critically, to write, to be able to communicate orally. And then I think, and this is something certainly that we stress at Canisius, you know, strong sense of ethics, you know, understanding right from wrong. Most employers say, if you deliver a graduate that looks like that, we can take care of the rest. But when they say we can take care of the rest, that means they need a lot of industry-specific training, things that they know will make this person successful in this particular line. And that's where we need to build on undergraduate education and deliver, you know, kind of a life approach to how am I going to learn. So if I come out of Canisius with a finance degree, that isn't the end. It's really just the beginning.
I think you're 100% accurate, and that's exactly what we're going through right now in our company. We're redeveloping our whole, to use the word develop, our whole career development curriculum, because this isn't my father's industry or my grandfather's industry. It's my son's industry and perhaps his children's industry, and how we move with the rest of the world, like any industry does or should, really will spell our long-term success. And we'll be right back with more from Our House to Yours after these important messages.
Hi, this is Linda Malaya, president of Hunt Mortgage. When it comes to the single biggest purchase of your life, it pays to shop around. If you think you've found the best rate available for your home loan, why not let us take a second look? We'll review your rates and your terms and try to see if we can do better. And just for giving us a shot, we'll give you a $50 gift card.
Hunt Mortgage is a licensed mortgage banker, New York Department of Financial Services, and an equal opportunity lender.
Welcome back to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the all-new HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience. And the show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, and Hunt Mortgage is the home of the low rate and closing cost guarantee, and also the home of the pre-purchase commitment. I'm in the studio today with John Hurley. Mr. Hurley is the president of Canisius College, and we've been discussing, in a broad sense, education, its impact on the economy, our local economy, and factors impacting that, as well as Canisius College itself. John, before we go any further in our dialogue, let's take a couple callers. This is John from Rochester. John, how can we help you?
Hey, Peter. Hey, John. Yeah, you guys were talking about people leaving the state. I'll give you an extreme example. Tom Golisano left New York for Florida residents. He saved, according to newspaper reports, $6 to $7 million a year in state income tax. So that means that comes out of our state coffers and has to be made up. But and that's happening, not to that extreme, but that's one of the problems. But the thing I'd like to comment, John, is on Canisius College. I'm impressed with Kevin Hardwick, who does the show on WBEN, and he's a professor of political science there. And he seems to be a really even-tempered guy, and he's the type of individual you'd like your kids to be taught by, versus some of the state schools like UB and Buffalo State. I've noticed their political science professors are really leftist. Now, one exception is James Campbell at UB, who I think is a Kevin Hardwick type person. What's your comment on that? And do you attract people that are sick of the leftist agenda?
Well, Kevin is a great guy. I love working with him, and he's a big favorite among the students. There's no question about that. And Kevin is he's an academic who also has, you know, 1 foot squarely in the political and in realm. So he brings the real world into the classroom. As to the politics or the leanings of a faculty, you know, that doesn't really enter into the equation. I think colleges and universities, it's no secret, they tend to the more progressive side of things. And it's I don't know exactly why that is, but we welcome all perspectives at the college, and I think our students are best served by an exposure to all perspectives, because there are as many problems on the right as there are on the left, and I think both ought to be investigated in a classroom. You know, universities the fundamental purpose of a university and what drives us is the search for truth. And right now, I think in this country, we need to have some very serious conversations about truth. And these are philosophical discussions, but then they're also, you know, like, how is that going to influence your life? And that's what we're trying to teach our students. So I like people coming at things from every perspective. I encourage our faculty to be open-minded when we invite speakers to campus. And the like, and I think it's an important part of the education.
I think I couldn't agree more, and I think oftentimes the examples of the extremes are all we hear about, and we don't hear about the what I would describe as a happier middle ground, where we do have a sharing of various perspectives as you describe. Our next caller is Gustav from Williamsville. Gustav, how can we help you?
Good morning. You were talking about lifelong learning, and it strikes me that one of the speed bumps against that is just the difficulty of learning software. Each of these new things that you learn seems to be a new software program. And I'm wondering if Canisius specifically tries to encourage the ability to learn disparate softwares, different platforms as part of a general curriculum. I have no idea. I'm just asking a question.
Well, a net score, I'm not sure. I'll answer it as best I can. You know, my experience with young people is they are very intuitive, and they can open up something. And, you know, it's amazing to me that we get phones and other pieces of technology with no instruction booklets. Our generation is an instruction booklet generation. The young people pick it up, and kids as young as 7, 8, 9 are intuitive. They can figure it out. And so I think there's less of a demand to have a lot of hands-on instruction on different things because they just take so easily to it. But for, if we're talking about lifelong learning and we're trying to bring people into a program, yeah, we're going to have to address how they might access it. We have a learning platform at Canisius called D2L where courses are run through that. So the syllabus is posted there, assignments are delivered there, class notes, class discussion are all on the platform. And every student at Canisius is instructed as to how to access that and use that. But it's pretty self-evident. I mean, I've got access to D2L for different. We use it to manage some committees at the college, and like they didn't have to really give me an instruction. You just click on it, and it's pretty clear what you do.
And I think all programs are getting more, as you say, intuitive, so that it doesn't require, all of a sudden complete change of frame of mind to get into the mode of being able to use the software. But I think Gustav brings up a good point. And I think the real issue that we find inside our industry and in terms of our communication with the public is fear. I think people, once they get to a point in life where they've got something mastered, to think that they've got to learn something else completely is foreign to them. Just the evolution of the smartphone has been a real, kind of a crisis almost in many demographic segments of our community. I'm not so sure that any college could keep up with all that. So you have to just kind of pick your point, as you say, with the platform that you're operating from, and it sounds as though it's widely accepted. And I think most schools have such a platform. It may even be the same thing.
Yeah, there are several of these, and in schools, it's become the way education is delivered. The other point about this is people can decide at some point in their lives, like, I saw this years ago, people say, oh, I'm not going to get on email. And you can make that choice, but when you watch the pace of change, I mean, you might think, well, I don't have to be on this. This isn't going to affect my life, but you become isolated.
Right.
And so I think, increasingly you have to be adaptive to new technologies to keep up. And I just look at the way my professional life has changed over the course of my career. You know, I'm about 40 years out of law school, and I went from, carbon paper and typewriters to a point where 95% of my communication is electronic now. I mean, I almost don't even need a landline at the college. I get so few live telephone calls.
You know, it's so interesting. I remember asking my grandfather when we were buying our first set of really sophisticated copiers throughout our company years and years ago. I said, "Gramps, how did you survive without copiers?" And he said, "It's called carbon paper."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, if you make one mistake, though, you're in real trouble." So the, you're right. It's been a massive quantity of change over that 40-year period, as you describe, and the pace is only accelerating, as we saw this week, for example, with Apple, one of the leading in terms of innovative elements of the technological world, being valued over $1 trillion. And 5 years ago, I don't think any of us could even thought about any company in the world being worth $1 trillion, and there it is, and there's a couple on its heels, which is astounding to me, and it's all based on technology. So I'm not sure where we go with how Canisius keeps up. But let's go back to one other topic here, because I think we could speculate about technology for the rest of our lives. I want to put Canisius back in the context of our community here for a second, and it just is more of an opinion from you. But there's a lot of discussion going on in the business community right now about how we maintain the momentum of our of the things going well in our community, how we maintain that. How does Canisius fit into that dialogue, and how can, or any of the educational institutions, how do we really keep this going in spite of all that stuff we talked about in the first segment that is not going to go away?
Yeah, I think there are two parts of it. I look at the positive developments in the community, the entrepreneurship, all the developments at the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus, this investment in life sciences and the discoveries that we expect to come from that. And I'm challenging our faculty every day to say, how is it that Canisius College plays a role in that, in our programs, in what we're preparing our students to do, and in encouraging our students to become a part of it? So we're looking for linkages and partnerships all over the community to take advantage of that. At the same time, there are segments of the community who caution us not to assume that this is all a positive picture. There are many problems, Peter, that you and I have worked on throughout our careers here in Buffalo that remain, mm-hmm. and we have to keep sight of that. And so I'm challenging our faculty to say, how does Canisius play a, you know, as much as we talk about the new Buffalo, how do we keep the focus on the unsolved problems of the old Buffalo and keep going on those? So there, it's a mixed picture in some ways, and the college. You know, that's one of the key parts of a college in a community is to play a role and to have an impact in the community. And we see ourselves as having an impact in lots of ways, and we're constantly looking for new ways.
I know Canisius has been very involved in your own neighborhood, and your own neighborhood would be an example of what I would describe as the uneven positive impact of all the things you mentioned, the medical campus, et cetera, et cetera. I know you've dealt with it from a real estate housing perspective, but how else are you looking at those uneven beneficial elements that from all the good things that are happening in this community?
Yeah, well, we're looking at schools, Buffalo Public Schools that are in the vicinity of the college in Hamlin Park, School 17 at near Main and Delavan, 54 up at near Main and Leroy, and saying how do we partner with schools that are in our backyard where we can offer things. Lots of things that we want to bring children onto the campus for math and reading. And then we like to partner with, like, the Hamlin Park taxpayers. You know, if they've got priorities as a community, how can the college be part of that? And I'm constantly in contact with them.
In our last minute or so, John, give us kind of a brief summary of your perspective over the next couple of years for Canisius.
Well, higher education is a challenging place right now, but, you know, Canisius College, if you look, we're getting ready to celebrate our sesquicentennial, 150 years in the 2019-20 academic year. And we've grown from a small building down on Washington Street to this thriving campus on Main Street, and I think the future's bright, and we're anxious to play a part in this community as we have from our founding in 1870.
I think part of that is your role in the community, John. I want to compliment you on all the things that you've done at Canisius and before and after and during your involvement as president, because I think, like it or not, every school, every institution boils down to its leadership at one point or another in terms of the perspective from the rest of the community. I want to compliment you on all the good things you're doing at Canisius, and I want to thank you for being with us on the show today, John. I hope to have you back sometime again soon so we can continue this dialogue.
Thanks so much, Peter. Always love being here.
I'd like to thank our listeners. This is Peter Punt. We'll be back at the same time next week. And remember, when it comes to real estate, Western New York and all upstate is Hunt Country.